This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. If you ask a sports fan to list the top five NBA teams, they will likely answer. If you talk to an urban planner, they can likely rattle off the country's most populous cities. Environmentalist Paul Hawken wanted a simple list of the top solutions to climate change, but even among scientists, he could find no one who could give him an answer. So he set out to make one. He gathered data to map, measure, and model existing solutions and projected 30 years into the future to see their effects on global warming. His team discovered some surprising answers about which climate change interventions offer the most bang for our buck. Paul Hawkins, the editor of Project Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. He'll be at Quail Ridge Books tonight in Raleigh, but first joins me on the State of Things. Paul, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Hey, thank you, Jeff.
Tell us more about this book itself and sort of how it came about, your plan behind this book.
Well, it came about exactly as you described, which is a question. I wanted to know what the top 100 solutions were to global warming. And sort of like Diogenes, you know, looking around, you can Google them. They're there, and they'll say things like forego fossil fuels and put a power strip in your entertainment center. That's from the Union of Concerned Scientists. I mean, just such frivolous things in the scope of the problem. They're very important things. They're good things, but they're just so tiny. And this goes back 15 years, actually, since the third assessment from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And I just wanted to know as an individual, also as a journalist, but also as an environmentalist, I want to know, where do we stand? What do we know what to do? Is it affordable? Will it have impact? Does it scale? It's just like if you go to a town, you want a kind of a map, you know, kind of where am I? Where's this? Where's that? You want to orient yourself. And I felt like I never got oriented in terms of this, you know, super wicked civilizational problem that surmounts anything we've ever confronted before as a civilization, and yet we're sort of, you know, sort of wandering around talking about, well, I think we should do this and that and so forth. And I found that frustrating.
So to be clear, we know there's a problem. We know there are solutions. People have been talking about various solutions. But what you're looking for is some kind of order. What will give us, you know, and how much of the problem will any one of these solutions solve? And that's what you set out to do.
Yeah.
And actually did some of the math around these. Tell us a little bit about let's give us an example. Why don't we do spoiler alert? Why don't you just go to number one right now and we'll talk about that, because I want to talk about both the solutions and some of the process.
Well, it's interesting because we have to measure model solutions as separate entities. So, for example, we measure offshore wind and onshore wind as two separate solutions. We measure rooftop solar and solar farms separately because the math is different on the economic side. So the number one solution is actually a little bit deceptive in some ways. Ranking strictly by silo, by separate solution, the top one is refrigerant management, which is the gases that are used in air conditioning and refrigerators, any cooling system, and those are hydrofluorocarbons that replaced chlorofluorocarbons, which are CFCs, which were destroying the ozone, so they're replaced by HFCs, which are extraordinarily persistent greenhouse gases that are thousands of times more powerful than CO2 in their global warming potential. And the amendment to the Montreal Protocol, the Kigali Amendment, which was passed last year, phases them out starting in 2024, right through 2030. And so that's the number one solution, and you measure it in CO2 equivalents, that is to say, mm-hmm. the equivalent of CO2. And but if you then take the number two solution, which is onshore wind, and number 22, which is offshore, right. and combine them, that's the number one solution. And then there's a surprise number one solution when you combine two others, which I'll talk about tonight at Quail Ridge.
So, and what you've done too is kind of give us the math. In other words, you've shown us, okay, what would it cost to convert, to make this kind of changeover to whatever system you have? And you have quite a few here in the book that you talk about. And also to be clear, you're talking about things that are being done now. So it's not, there's not aspirational. These are solutions that are in the works one way or another.
Very important point. Every solution we model is well in hand, hands-on, practical, W.W. Grainger, this is not so we ought, should, or if only this, we could. No, it's we are doing all of these, and they're all scaling, which is very important. And so our growth projections are built off scaling that has and is occurring, as opposed to, again, sort of fantasizing about what could happen. Our solar projections are based on IEA and Ampere 450 models and the World Bank. And so, again, we're not trying to fantasize about the future so much as give us all a sense of where we are and what's going to happen if we continue to scale the solutions that are at hand. And our goal, overriding goal, was to see if we could reverse global warming, not to mitigate, not to reduce, not to stabilize emissions at 400 and whatever, 50 ppm parts per million in 2050, but to see if, in fact, we could reverse it, because the course we are on is to extraordinary climatic disruption, volatility, and there's no stability whatsoever, even at the levels of CO2 in the atmosphere today.
So what you do is you give us maybe the cost of converting or using, going from one model to another, and maybe there's a net cost, you know, in the conversion process or whatever that might be. And then there's a net savings for all of us, and we've got all that. And, of course, fascinatingly enough, and something that we probably should know, there's sometimes net savings even in the conversion. If we actually start to, you know, economize more and use less, those things actually save us money even in the short run. But we're not converting, and that kind of raises the other question is, what would it take and what combination of these solutions can we properly expect given our political climate and some of the other, you know, and just the way we think about problems?
Well, we think about our political climate, but it's just United States political climate. It's not Canada. It's not Mexico. It's not Denmark, Germany, China, France. The leadership in climate never was here in the United States. The federal government has never been a leader. It has never taken the moral high ground. Even when the president did, like Clinton and Obama, he was stopped by, they were both stopped by the Congress. So the idea that somehow we've abandoned that role is not true. We never had the role. The fact that we have somebody who's anti-science and ignorant of the problem and basically a shill for big business really has almost no effect at all on the growth of these solutions, because they don't come from the federal government. They don't come from the executive branch, and they actually don't even come from Congress. And so there are subsidies in solar and in wind production tax credits. But it's so interesting, because you can have this high-flying rhetoric about, you know, fossil fuels and coal and bring jobs back to West Virginia. But when you talk about stopping the production tax credit for wind, well, wind corridor in the United States is basically from North Dakota to Texas. And you paint those really red if you're a political scientist. And as Chuck Grassley said, the Republican senator of Nebraska, when it was reported back to him that Trump wants to get rid of the production tax credit, he said, over my dead body. So what's happening is that these technologies and techniques are jobs. They're producing jobs. There's two times as many people working in solar than coal right now. And coal is declining and solar is increasing. And so the fact that the administration is going against the wind, against economic just common sense, is not going to persist.
Well, but I do wonder about that, because you talked about the fact that the U.S. has not taken, and you used the term, the moral high ground on Kyoto, the first global climate agreement. It wasn't just a moral high ground. There were economic benefits which the Germans reaped in the hundreds of billions, and that the U.S. lost because it was not a signatory. And so we did understand that by pandering to the automotive and oil industries in the way that we did, we lost jobs and we lost billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars in economic development that went to Germany and other nations that landed on it.
Quite right.
So, and my point is, I know this, and a lot of other people know it, and it was well reported. It really hasn't changed the rhetoric around this. And so I'm wondering what it would take to sort of change our consciousness about this not being a moral question, only a moral question.
Well, the thing is about the governments can greatly accelerate these solutions. And you see that in Denmark. You see that in Germany. You see that now in China. China is doing extraordinary things. You see that in France. You don't see it here. It really never has happened. And so it's not that government can't be a great boon to this, but the idea that somehow it can be sandbagged by the U.S. government is not true. That's what I'm trying to say.
And you also say in this book, you point out that there are other players that are equally large and larger in some cases, the market, private corporations, NGOs. So tell us about their role in this and how you see it playing out.
It's interesting, because I do know a lot of large corporations and consult with them informally. And except for the auto industry, I don't know one single corporation that is changing their 5-10-year environmental plan, their sustainability, one iota because of this administration. They look at it and go, okay. But they plan 10, 20, 30 years out, and they're looking at this just, I think, as many of us do, as an aberration as opposed to a trend. And I would say the exception is the car industry, the automobile industry, which kind of made a deal with the American people, which is we will accept a bailout and we will, for that, agree to higher mileage standards for our fleets. And at least Chrysler and GM did, and Ford didn't take a bailout. And now that Trump is offering to basically roll back those mileage standards, they're just rushing to it and accepting it. And that, to me, is somebody should call them on that, really. It hasn't really – it's not in the news.
Well, what are the ways in which non-governmental organizations and other means outside of government, if you're saying that there are at least barriers at the moment and obstacles, even they may be temporary, what are some of the other ways in which sort of either grassroots organizations or even the market itself might play a role?
Well, the NGOs are very, very active. They're active on a not on that highest level because they don't have access, but citizens, climate lobbies, 30,000 people out there who are basically lobbyists on local levels, school boards, city councils, counties, and so forth, 30,000 people working on that daily. NGOs are all over the world. Some are based here, but some are not, working with countries, working with cities, countries, in the sense of their leaders. We, even though we've only been out 8 days, we are now working with the Commonwealth of Nations, and the Secretary General, the Baroness Patricia Janet Scotland, has asked us and now is actually appointing Drawdown and designating it as the template for economic and ecological regeneration of almost one-third of humanity in the Commonwealth of Nations. So we're finding access to, and we're an NGO, we're a nonprofit as well. So we're finding a great, great deal of receptivity and understanding that the worm is sort of turning on this globally.
What do you do? Again, this is a compendium of solutions that are already in the works in which you kind of do the math and thread out 30 years from now, if this was to scale, what it might look like in terms of savings and protection of the environment, rolling back climate change. But there are dynamics in this, and you recognize in this in the book. When you try to compute this sort of things, you do it in a silo. But now, in a big, wide world where things are changing and having an effect on each other, it's pretty hard to make this calculation over 30 years, isn't it?
It is. We didn't compute it in a silo, though. We actually took that into consideration. But those system dynamics are also imputed. That is to say, they may be computed, but in a sense, there's a sum of inputs going into those system dynamics. And so we didn't do single model solutions, but or single solution models. However, having said that, our role is to update the information constantly. So that's why on an ongoing basis, so you can go to the website and go, okay, now it's this, now it's this, it's better, it's not as good, it's done this, this has happened. The one criticism we had from, we have 128 advisors, we have 40 outside expert reviewers, and the consistent criticism that we had is that our numbers are too conservative, our costs are too high, and our growth projections are too low. And that is exactly our intention. That was what we intended to in a sense, engender from experts, from people who look at this and understand it and say, no. We did not want anybody to say, oh, you've egged the pudding, you're fantasizing, your feet are not on the ground. This is very grounded scientific data. Every carbon number is based on only peer-reviewed papers, not anecdotes, not beliefs, not somebody's,
Let's get into a couple of these systems just in broad strokes and ways in which things are already underway and could be scaled up. I mean, let's talk in about a general category. Let's look at land management and how that might help us.
Land management is interesting because the IPCC and other institutions have treated land as sort of like other, like, oh, yeah, carbon goes back every year, it cycles oceans and land. We treated it very differently. First, we couldn't measure it. If you just think of forests, farms, and grasslands, those aren't measurable solutions. So in the process of actually looking at land use, we had to look for the specific land use that had been studied by scientists. So we came up with 22 different land use solutions. We don't measure agroforestry. We measure tree intercropping, silvopasture, multi-strata agroforestry. And so actually, this is the first time ever that there has been this sense of both splitting in a biological sense of parsing these categories in a way that actually you can account for them. That is to say, measure and so forth. And we use basically FAO data to understand every single hectare on the planet, on the globe, and how it's being used right now. So we weren't double counting, which is often what you see, these projections. And it turns out that land use is an extraordinary, and the only way, by the way, that we can actually reverse global warming is to bring carbon back down through photosynthesis into the plants, the roots, the biomass, and of course the soil and soil organisms. But that is the area where the solutions are very, and no pun intended, but ground up. I mean, they're not really top down at all. There isn't no big company that can come in and say, we're going to make, you know, big solar factory in China. Land use is really cultural. It's in place. And probably one of the most surprising things is that, again, in the sort of the red Midwest states, you're seeing a tremendous shift away from big ag, pesticides, herbicides, GMOs, to regenerative agriculture, not for altruistic reasons, not to be certified, because it works better. And they're losing their soil. They were losing their farms. They're going to lose their, you know, several generations of legacy. And now they're moving to complex cover crops, you know, and getting away from soy corn.
Drawdown, we're talking about the top ways we can reverse global warming today on The State of Things. It's a compendium of projects and solutions edited by Paul Hawken, who is my guest this hour. And another area that it seems to me the market could play a big role is in mass transportation. That's where people, again, are demanding cheaper transportation and cleaner transportation.
That's a fascinating area because studies have shown that actually, you know, for like a city like New York, you know, to increase its mass transit is extraordinarily unaffordable, frankly. I mean, and cities are just looking at this problem of they've got a glut of traffic, but in order to alleviate that, they would go bankrupt. But there is some really interesting solutions coming out and proposals for not just autonomous vehicles, actually, which is for sure there, but actually dedicated lanes, pods, this, that, really changing our whole concept of mobility. Mobility is very important for human beings. But the way we have, and I think you've spoken to this in the past, you know, the way we've expressed mobility is just absurd. You know, 4,000 pounds of steel, iron, and glass, and so forth to move around a 120-pound woman. And nothing could have been more of greater folly, you know, in terms of mobility. Except mobility is really important to people, and it is in the society. And so you're starting to see people look at this in a very, very different way, more like you would see in a stream, you know, with polywogs or, you know, little protozoa, or which you would see in ants or termite hills and so forth, you know, very micro vehicles, you know, that are they're electric, that are quiet, that move around, that are there at your disposal, and really the end of the basically the automobile industry. And I think many of the automobile companies actually know that that's coming.
Well, there are plenty of solutions here and plenty more to talk about. And I thank you so much for talking with us today and giving us at least a taste. Paul Hawken, thank you so much.
Jeff, thank you.
He is the editor of Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming. Paul is going to be at Quail Ridge Books tonight at 7 o'clock in Raleigh. Just ahead, a new podcast looks at the underexplored world of philosophical questions, and it does it through storytelling. We'll talk about it on The State of Things. Stay tuned.